From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. On our interfaith calendar, Monday marks the autumn equinox observed as Mabon in the Northern Hemisphere and Ostara in the Southern Hemisphere by pagans and Wiccans. Wednesday evening is the beginning of the Jewish High Holiday of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, which continues until sundown on Friday. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Be fruitful and multiply and take dominion of the earth. And the mentality of a Quiverful family says that wasn't just a suggestion, that's a command from God.
The more children we have, the more children there are and more people to spread that good news.
It's a model that situates fathers and husbands in a role of absolute power.
Men as almighty rulers of their families. Women obedient and submissive. Children as numerous as possible. Does that sound like something from an earlier century? Maybe so. But what's known as the Quiverful movement is growing among evangelical Christians in this country, comfortably integrated with the broader dominionist philosophy of fundamentalist dominance in culture and government. And predictably, it's taking a human toll. On this week's show, you'll meet one former follower of this extreme philosophy when I'm joined by activist Vicki Garrison. Around the world, Jews are preparing for Rosh Hashanah. They're doing so this year in the face of a surge in anti-Semitism that really goes beyond anything we've seen in a very long time. What timeless lessons do the Hebrew Scriptures offer for renewal and new beginnings at this new year? And how can those lessons be applied to the challenges of today for all of us? I'll ask Rabbi Sharon Brous, head of the Ikar community in Los Angeles.
The number of marriage cases before the U.S. Supreme Court keeps climbing, with the court scheduled to decide which ones to take in just a few weeks.
With only a very few exceptions, marriage equality has been on the march in this country. In state after state, judges have interpreted last year's Supreme Court decisions on DOMA and California's Prop 8 as encouraging a view of marriage as a constitutional right. Thing is, that's not something the High Court has spelled out so clearly yet. But as the new Supreme Court session draws near, there are many voices on both the right and the left calling for the justices to take up this issue on the national level. On this week's show, I'll talk to attorney Chantel Feibig, who works closely with the American Foundation for Equal Rights, on the issue of marriage equality. But first,
ISIL must be defeated, period. End of story.
Our intelligence community has not yet detected specific ISIL plots against our homeland.
The United States has launched airstrikes at Islamic State or ISIL targets.
Different as Obama's plan is from the military course our nation took in 2001, what seems to have not changed is our unwillingness to have an honest conversation about the real-world implications of U.S. military action overseas. Stepping up to fill that void is Dr. Susan Brooks Thistlewaite. Susan, I am so pleased to have you join us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton, and I am very pleased to be here. These are serious subjects.
You've written a strongly worded piece for On Faith, arguing that the situation with the terror group ISIS does not rise to the threshold of just war theory. We probably should begin with you reminding our listeners about what just war theory is.
Let's imagine that the listeners are all in my classroom on peace and war, and I've drawn on the board crusade, which is the Christian and other religious holy war, and all the way at the other end of the board, I've drawn pacifism. Everybody knows that is the principled opposition to war. Now, just war theory developed in the middle from both some philosophical sources, but also from St. Augustine and St. Aquinas, saying there have to be limits on the use of force. And when is force moral? When is it immoral? So trying to find a space in between. And so this theory, which is actually taught at the War College and has criteria of when it's moral to get in to a war or not, and how you're supposed to conduct a war.
So what would need to be different about the situation to permit ethical military intervention?
Leading criterion for just war theory is just cause, okay, that you have a just cause. And it is not considered just to just go attack anybody you want to. Remember, this came up with the attack on Iraq. You know, did we have a just cause? And so I argue that the president said that no, ISIL has not threatened the American homeland. They haven't been able to find any such threats, et cetera, et cetera. This is in the president's speech. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel said the words immediate threat in reference to the killing of the two Americans. Now, immediate threat, that's code for just war theory. But killing of two Americans, not on American soil, but elsewhere, I would still dispute is not an immediate threat. Now, another criterion that we just do not pay attention to is what is the probability of success? You're not supposed to get into a war, says just war theory, if you can't see any good outcome, if you can't see that it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Both Pew Research and CNN have polling somewhere, you know, between 60 to 63% of Americans are in favor of bombing ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
But under a third, approximately, actually think it will work.
Hmm.
So that shows the dilemma that Americans seem to feel they're in, which is we have to do something. These are hideous people. I mean, this is just insupportable, right?
Mm-hmm.
ISIL is brutal. They behead people. They execute people. They tried to commit genocide. They enslave women. I mean, nothing redeeming about these folks.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, what's the most effective thing? Now, I propose two in my article.
Mm-hmm.
One being political solution. They came about, of course, because of the bad performance of the Iraqi government in excluding the Sunnis from the government. The ISIL people preyed upon Sunni feelings of exclusion. But then secondly, go get their money. There's an estimate that ISIL is bringing in $3 million a day.
Mm-hmm.
You drug money, a lot of it, and also oil money, which is, of course, also theft. So you try to go after their money. A lot of people aren't believers in this stupid ideology, which is neither Islamic, say many, many Muslims,
mm-hmm.
nor actually are they a state, right? They're a group
mm-hmm.
of thugs. Go get their money. But that doesn't look like doing something, right? It doesn't look like we're fighting terrorism. So Americans have got to get smarter about how we find these folks. And I think just war theory provides a couple of really good questions you ought to ask yourself. If you don't really think it's going to be successful, which two-thirds of Americans apparently don't,
mm-hmm.
why not try something that works? And I think most people could get on board with go get their money.
You criticize mm-hmm. the strategic aspects of the president's plan, and I'd like for you to talk about the idea that ISIS needs an enemy, and we're doing them somewhat a favor by giving them one.
Yes, ISIL has issued us an invitation to a cosmic war, right?
Mm-hmm.
They are a group of people with a highly inflated sense of their own importance, and they think they are fighting a cosmic war. They need the United States, a.k.a. what they would demonize as the great Satan.
Mm-hmm.
They need us to get into this conflict for recruitment, for ideological purposes, for symbolism. This happened in relationship to the 9/11 attacks, where suddenly it got made into a cosmic war, and we played that game.
Mm-hmm.
We played that game. And I think this is another place where we need to be smarter. Now, there are a lot of voices on the right, in particular, buying this come and get us, guys, invitation from ISIL. And I think we need to realize that this is a ploy on their part. They want the great Satan to show up with their bombs because they find it a good recruiting tool. And they are kind of a brutal group of thugs with a really good media strategy. Let's at least step back for a second and ask ourselves, are we being played in terms of an invitation to a cosmic war? Suppose we said no. Suppose we just said, no, we're coming for your money, and we're going to work on what worked the last time in the Sunni Awakening. That's what really turned the tide in the Iraq War. Suppose we're going to work on a political solution, and we're going to work on coming to get your money, and we don't play the game of the great Satan. What about that?
Susan, when you say, let's go after the politics of it and the money involved, there are many Americans who are inherently going to be thinking, but that's not really war. That's not really getting them. We've got to get into this conflict and show them who's boss.
Yes, yes, particularly the latter, because there is that simplistic equation, force is showing them who's boss. Mm-hmm. And it's a complicated world and a multilateral world. And I mean, I actually think President Obama has been boxed in by this. It is a very much an election season.
Mm-hmm.
I think his articulated approach to foreign policy, which he's done in previous months, you know, I think they're very aware in the foreign policy establishment and in the White House of the need to have a very nuanced foreign policy.
Yeah.
But reason, as I wrote in the column, reason has left the building. And people fall for this. They
yeah.
fall for it. They get all panicky. And I look at these conservative pundits on the TV who are saying war, 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 and I think, I wonder who's paying you for that, because war is very profitable.
Yeah.
I think that we've got to be very suspicious that the drumbeat of war is also just a profit center. It makes me very, very suspicious.
I can hear some people who are listening to this interview saying, well, I thought you all started out talking about just war, which means that you're concerned about morality. And if
mm-hmm.
if you're really concerned about morality and you see that dastardly group of people doing what they're doing to human beings who don't by any means deserve that, isn't it more moral to take them out? Isn't it more moral for us to defend these people that are getting killed rather than talking about doing politics and finances?
The really helpful thing about just war theory is that it does ask you this question. Not just should you do it, but what's most effective?
Yeah.
Are you going to be effective?
Yeah.
And the question that I then am raising here is, what's most effective to play into the game of being the great Satan and alienating a whole bunch more people and therefore being a recruitment tool for ISIL, therefore making this region, which is grossly unsafe, even more unsafe? Or should we be moral by actually being smart and effective in how we combat this threat? The end game is the same. The end game is these folks have got to go. I feel that they've got to go. I work a lot out of the just peace paradigm and actually working on financial strategies to dry up the drug money, political strategies. These are actually strategies of just peace, but they overlap with just war mm-hmm. in this criterion. And the criterion is, do you have an exit strategy?
Yeah.
Do you have a good outcome? We went into that war in Iraq, and actually I think also into the war in Afghanistan, with no exit strategy. I mean, actually Colin Powell said this on numerous occasions. We have mm-hmm. no exit strategy.
If you were in D.C. or wherever, and you had a chance to have 1 minute with Barack Obama and another minute with John McCain,
mm-hmm.
what would you say to each of them?
Well, I've been on television with John McCain opposing the Iraq war. And I'll say the same thing I said then, don't do it. With President Obama, I would be able to say, this is a more effective strategy, Mr. President. I actually think you know it. And I think that you're right to try to dial it down, as you have been trying to do in your foreign policy, and people will not listen to him.
The Reverend Dr. Susan Brooks Thistlewaite is professor of theology at Chicago Theological Seminary, the author of the book Dreaming of Eden, American Religion and Politics in a Wired World. Susan's recent article titled Obama's ISIL Strategy, Just More Endless War, Why President Obama's Planned Military Strikes on ISIS Do Not Fit the Criteria for a Just War, appears in the On Faith section of faithstreet.com, and we will link to it from stateofbelief.com. Susan, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton, for having me.
Marriage equality has made incredible progress in the past couple of years as state-by-state court decisions clear the way for more and more Americans legally to marry a same-gender partner. Now, with a growing clamor for the Supreme Court to weigh in on the issue on a national level, I'm joined by attorney Chantel Fiebig, who works closely on marriage equality with the American Foundation for Equal Rights. Chantel, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Could you help us understand the identity of the groups on either side of these calls for Supreme Court action?
Sure. We represent two same-sex couples, one who was married in California and seek to have their marriage recognized by the Commonwealth of Virginia, and then another couple that wants to be married in Virginia, but they were denied a marriage license because they are a same-sex couple. And across the country, most of these cases are being brought by individual couples like our clients who are seeking relief from the courts. There are, in some instances, class actions, meaning an entire class of gay and lesbian individuals who seek to marry a partner of their choosing. We have a class of plaintiffs actually involved in our case now on appeal. On the other side of the debate, generally tend to be state officials who are defending the laws in the states where they have been elected. So, for example, in Utah, that lawsuit is being defended by public officials there. In our case in Virginia, what we've seen is the Attorney General undertake an independent constitutional assessment of the constitutionality of these laws, and he reached the conclusion that he could not and would not defend the laws any longer. And so instead of the Attorney General of Virginia defending Virginia's marriage ban, we have two local court clerks who are responsible for issuing the marriage licenses defending these laws. So as a general matter, what we see are gay couples on one side, state officials on the other side.
Tell our listeners about the mechanics that the justices have to be concerned about in deciding whether or not to involve themselves. Is it a matter of them choosing a relevant case out of a number that are available to them, or is it something else?
They'll want to choose a case where they can consider all aspects of the marriage equality question. So, for example, in certain cases, there are couples who are seeking the right to marry, but the court is not presented with the question of whether an out-of-state marriage has to be recognized by a state as legal. And so the best vehicle for the court to decide this issue will let the court decide the question from all angles. So that will be, I think, one of the primary decision-making components for the Supreme Court in choosing which case to decide.
Well, when we got the rulings on DOMA and Prop 8, I think the perception was that the justices were wanting at least to move slowly and cautiously, and at times it even had the feel they didn't want to do anything at all that was as big as the kind of decision we're looking at. Do you think it's changed among the justices?
Well, I think certainly justices, it would be difficult for them to be immune to the changes that everyone has seen across the country, which includes the virtually unanimous cascade of decisions finding in favor of marriage equality from the other federal courts. And when the court decided Prop 8 in DOMA last summer, they didn't have the benefit of very careful legal analysis from so many lower courts to inform their decision. So mm-hmm. that will certainly be different when the case comes up this year.
Well, you've been right on top of this all along. When you came out of the decisions related to DOMA and Prop 8, did you think we would move with this amount of speed to get a decision from the High Court?
I don't think anyone could have predicted that the issues would develop as quickly as they have, but needless to say, we are thrilled that the case led by Ted Olson and David Boies and Prop 8 and to be so rapidly followed by the string of federal decisions to now be in a position to potentially be before the Supreme Court again in a case that doesn't have any of the procedural deficiencies that precluded the court from deciding the question in Prop 8, that is very exciting.
Evidently, people on both sides of the issue are equally optimistic regarding what the High Court might say. I'm just curious how you view that.
I don't know that both sides could reasonably be as optimistic. I think that the communities working in favor of marriage equality have good reason to be optimistic about the outcome and to hope that the Supreme Court will come down on the right side of history. But I think what we've seen from proponents of these marriage bans is a cooling of their optimism, mm-hmm. of their likelihood of prevailing. And I think we've seen that in some of the state court officials that have decided that they will no longer defend litigations where it is clear to them that the writing is on the wall and that these laws inevitably must fall.
Yeah. Well, we're getting awfully close to the first Monday in October. Do you think the Supreme Court's likely to take this on in next month's session?
We're optimistic that they will. It's hard to tell what the Supreme Court will do at this stage of the proceedings, but they have several cases that are all fully presented to the court and primed for resolution. So if they ever would like to consider the case, they have many qualified candidates to select from.
Would you hazard a guess as to where this matter will stand a year from now?
I would hope a year from now that we have a decision on marriage equality that recognizes the fundamental right of gay men and women across the country to marry the person that they love. And I hope that in whichever case or whichever number of cases the Supreme Court decides to consider the issue in, the Supreme Court will do so in a way that secures that right for all gay men and women across the country.
Chantel Fiebig is counsel with Gibson Dunn in Washington, D.C., who works closely on marriage equality with the American Foundation for Equal Rights. AFER has invaluable resources on its website at afer.org for understanding the current status of marriage equality and the possible scenarios that might lead to a nationwide ruling from the Supreme Court. Chantel, helpful information from you. Thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Vicki Garrison calls her departure from the fundamentalist world of quiverful families an escape. She spent decades of her life in a world where father not only knows best, but is assured by God Almighty that he does. Today, she authors a popular section at Patheos titled No Longer Quivering, and she works with other survivors of this extremist movement. As recent NFL domestic abuse scandals have sparked a national conversation on that subject, it's essential for us to take a look at what some label spiritual abuse. And so I'm very pleased to welcome Vicki Garrison to State of Belief Radio. Welcome, Vicki.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Would you start with just a short definition of the quiverful movement?
Basically, they take the verse in Psalm 127, which says, "The children are a blessing of the Lord. Blessed is the man who has his quiver full of them."
Mm-hmm.
They take that and say, children are a blessing, and so I'm going to be open to receiving willingly and happily every blessing which the Lord sends my way. And so basically it's no birth control. And the second tenet that is very, very important is the patriarchy, the headship and submission teaching, in which the man is the one who is ultimately responsible for the spiritual well-being of his wife and family.
Because everybody in the quiver belongs to the man, right?
There's a lot of emphasis on authority and on hierarchy, and God has put these very strict gender roles into place, and that if you line up with that and you live accordingly, then things are going to just be so much smoother for your family.
Yeah. But how does it go for the wife? Or does that matter?
On our website, No Longer Quivering, we misspell quivering. We spell it without a U. And our subtitle says there is no U in quivering. Huh. The point is that you really aren't even supposed to consider what's in this for me, or how do I feel about it, or is this good for me, whatever. You're only supposed to be thinking, what does God want?
Vicki, how widespread is this in our country?
When Catherine Joyce wrote her book, Quiverful, about the Christian patriarchy movement, she estimated maybe 10,000 mm-hmm. families that are practicing it. But, you know, it kind of depends on how you define it, because even the Duggar family, who is classic Quiverful, if mm-hmm. you've seen them on 19 Kids and Counting on TLC, that reality TV show, mm-hmm. they say they're not Quiverful, and yet they are so Quiverful. So, you know, depending on how you define it and depending on how much of an extreme, I believe that Quiverful is just regular Christianity writ large, lived out to its logical conclusion. So I think that, you know, within evangelical Christianity, most of these beliefs are taught and accepted, but it's just to what degree are they actually putting it into practice?
My sense is that there are a lot of people who embrace at least part of the philosophy or ideology involved in Quiverful, and they may not be committed to having as many children as possible in order to replenish the earth with Christians, but they are very much committed to the idea of patriarchal authority.
Yes, and when you see the embrace of the Christian right, biblical family values, mm-hmm. that's code words for what I'm talking about here. There are these specific ideals of what it means to be a Christian family. And when you look at what they're teaching and you look at, you know, the pro-life movement, you look at the promise keepers, mm-hmm. you know, how to be a manly man, a godly man.
Right.
These are the kind of teachings which are prevalent within evangelicalism. If you listen to Focus on the Family, which has so much influence within that culture, these are all teachings that, you know, are the premise of the Quiverful movement.
Yeah. Vicki, what is your history with this ideology? Were you born into a family that embraced that, or did you marry into that, or how did that take place?
No, I was not raised in a very religious family at all. And in fact, part of the chaos of my upbringing made me long for a stable, this is how it's to be done, and kind of a formulaic way of saying, if I do this, here's going to be the outcome. What really got me into it, though, was through the homeschooling movement. I kind of ended up homeschooling on a fluke, but once I got in there and I started going to the conventions and I started looking at the materials that they present for curriculum for teaching your children at home, that's where I was really indoctrinated, so to speak, into this whole mindset of these biblical family values.
Yeah.
It's kind of they're selling this lifestyle to evangelical Christians.
Sure.
And Christian homeschooling families are an easy target, because the whole reason they start homeschooling in the first place is because they already accept the idea that you need to protect and shelter your children from the evil influence of, you know, the world.
Mm-hmm.
I call it fertile ground. When you go into the Christian homeschooling community, that's where you're really going to encounter these teachings.
What made you decide that you had to get out of this movement?
We had taken it to such an extreme. We had accepted it to such a depth that I totally had that martyr mentality in which I was willing to do whatever God required of me in order to live according to the principle of being open to receiving whatever blessings he wanted to send into my womb. And I have some health issues which made it an actual life-threatening condition for me. And so I did come very close to losing my life on several occasions during childbirth and delivery.
Mm-hmm.
it's really just such an unsustainable lifestyle. I would have to say, you know, that I burned out. I just realized I couldn't do it. And I looked at my kids and the fruit, you know, that verse says, by your fruits you will know them. Well, my fruit was not what I had been hoping for and working for. My kids were not happy. My kids were extremely oppressed. It was almost like their spirits were crushed by the heaviness and the burden of having this very strictly defined lifestyle laid out for them. You know, their lives, especially for the girls, are basically prepackaged and handed to them chapter and verse and said, this is what God wants for your life and this is how you're going to do it. There's no room for creativity. There's no room for autonomy. That was really showing in my children. When I saw the deadness in their eyes, I knew that something had to change.
It seems to me that the Quiverful movement is destructive to both men and women. I mean, men who are told they're always right, which can't be, and women who are subjugated to the men.
It is very, very harmful and destructive to the men. First of all, you know, it's really very interesting to me that one of the things that we heard over and over within Fundamentalist Christianity is about love and respect, you know, that men need to love their wives and women need to respect their husbands. But when you look at the actual dynamics of what's happening there, there is no respect for a man when you cannot stand up and say, hey, you're screwing up here. You have to just continually cater to him and to always submit and to always defer. And when you take that stance, you're treating him basically like a little toddler who is going to have a fit or get their feelings hurt if you just speak the truth to them. And so that's not respect. And the whole idea of love, you know, that the men are to love their wives like Christ loved the church. And we heard that, you know, continually. And so it's supposed to be the servant leadership. But that kind of love, when you put it into the strict gender roles and you have it so specifically defined, there's no room for any kind of emphasizing your strengths and trying to make up for your weaknesses. You have to conform to this very rigid, very narrow definition of love. And what happens there is that it just sucks the life and the spirit out of a relationship.
As Americans look on in horror at some of the recent NFL domestic abuse scandals, do you think the Quiverful philosophy kind of gives cover to some men prone to misogyny in the guise of religious teachings?
You know, I believe that not only does it give cover, but in many cases it actually inspires and baptizes that kind of behavior and says, this is how it is supposed to be. This is how you're supposed to be as a godly man, as a manly man. You're supposed to take charge. You're supposed to have control. You're supposed to exert your authority. Even though we have Jesus as our example, and of course we're not supposed to lord that over, and we're supposed to be a servant leader, etc. But in actual reality, when you continually tell a person that they are right, that God has placed them in this position and that they have this ultimate responsibility, the pressure and the huge head trip that a person can get on, it really destroys the man in his personality to the point where he's more concerned about control than he is about relationships. And he's more concerned about making things happen for the eternal good. And so he's not really focusing on what's happening right before him.
Vicki, talk for a second about the idea of spiritual abuse.
I define spiritual abuse as a system which allows for the manipulation and the exploitation of our very personal, very strong desire to be right with our Maker. Inside, we have this very deep longing. And when that is used and exploited to control a person and actually manipulate them into doing things that are against their own interests, you have a woman who wants to do the very best for her family. And she wants to do it because she has this feeling that there's a higher purpose. It's very easy to get in there and just mess with their brain and say, this is what God wants.
Vicki Garrison is a writer and activist who spent many years in the fundamentalist Quiverful Family movement. You'll find her invaluable work at patheos.com in the subsection titled No Longer Quivering. Vicki, I want to thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Rabbi Sharon Brous is a highly regarded faith leader, teacher, writer, and activist. She's the founder of the Ikar community in Los Angeles, tasked with reanimating Jewish life through soulful religious and spiritual practice that is rooted in a deep commitment to social justice. Oh, what a mission. With turmoil in the world all around us, it's important to take some time to hear the lessons Jewish teachings offer us for a time such as this, as a new year begins. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be with you.
Sharon, would you first describe Rosh Hashanah and its significance on the Jewish religious calendar?
The first day of the new year is actually a time of introspection and a time of communal gathering and self-assessment, what we call Cheshbon HaNefesh. It's an opportunity to take an accounting of the soul of the individual, the soul of the community, the soul of the world, and really determine if we're living as we ought to be. And if not, how do we need to realign? How do we need to adjust so that we can fully realize our potential in the world and really live in accordance with our truest values? That's the way that we enter into the new year every year.
So much of the Hebrew Scriptures is most relevant in troubled times. With the world in the shape it's in today, how should we feel and how should we move forward?
I think it's really important for us to take a step back out of some of the noise of current events, and it particularly, it's been an incredibly painful summer for many of us, a summer filled with heartache, to be able to step back and look with a different kind of perspective at what is actually the trajectory that we're on as a people and as human beings, and to see what power we might have in order to shape the course of history. So if we're moving in a direction that we like and that we want to affirm, how do we continue to fuel that effort? And if we see that history is moving in a direction that we don't like, what are we called to do, each of us as individuals and as communities, in order to help shape the future? And so we step out of the noise of the day-to-day in order to look and gain broader perspective on what's happening out in the world. So the first thing is, I think we have to remind ourselves of the possibility of finding, discovering, reaffirming hope, even in the midst of very dark and tumultuous and troubling times, that the journey that we move on is one that is in a trajectory from darkness to light, from slavery to freedom, from degradation to dignity, that's the arc that we ought to be following and have the potential to follow as human beings. Is that the trajectory we find ourselves on right now? And if not, what kind of realignment do we need to do?
I know that a great focus of Ikar is the bringing together of religion and direct action. What's Rosh Hashanah like at Ikar?
It's both a time of deep introspection and incredible outpouring of love and joy and affirmation of our core vision of what we think is possible for each one of us and for the world. And so you see laughter and you see tears. And the point here is to break into our calendar to take us out of our normal routine and create an environment that's so different from what we're used to that it forces us to think and feel differently for these 10 days from Rosh Hashanah through the end of Yom Kippur. And when that happens, we see an opening of the spirit, an opening of the heart. So it's very emotional. There's incredible spiritual depth. There's intellectual challenge. And there's movement of the heart, of the body. People are really investing, many of them for the first time, because a lot of our folks are previously very marginalized Jews, but people are really investing in trying to determine how we want to live. And the promise of the Jewish calendar is that if you don't like the way that you're living, you can actually change. You can unstick yourself, so to speak. And the calendar gives us the space to do that kind of contemplation and inner work so that we can manifest ourselves differently in the world once these holy days are over.
How do you do such serious contemplative work with yourself and then also extend that celebration of the new year into the community beyond your doors?
This work starts with the self, but never ends with the self, because ultimately this isn't about service of the self. This is about working in the world to transform the world. And so in order to do that effectively, I have to do a tremendous amount of inner work, and that doesn't happen once. That happens regularly. This holiday comes every year. But I'm not the end. I work to bring about a kind of healing and renewed sense of possibility internally, because the work of the world is tremendous and needs each of us to come from a place of strength and possibility and hope. So we invite people to start from where they are. Start with your own story. Where is your heart hurting this year? What are your struggles? What is the pattern that's imprisoning you right now, the dynamic, the relationship that makes you feel like you can't fully realize yourself? How do you work on that problem in order to liberate yourself so that you're able to look more broadly at what's going on in your city, in your country, and in the world?
Mm-hmm. Sharon, what kind of role will be given this New Year's festival time to the troubled Middle East, the rising anti-Semitism, which makes no sense? These matters that really do disturb people.
I think it's really critical to acknowledge that people are scared and people are hurting right now, particularly in the Jewish community, seeing the rise of anti-Semitism again across Europe, in Australia, and many incidents here in the United States. People are coming in differently this year than they've come in years past. And so to acknowledge that fear and then to articulate and rearticulate a vision of what it means to be a Jew and a human being in the world, to help move us as a community out of an identity that's fear-based and fear-driven into one that's more driven by the vision that we hold for what's possible in the world. So I want to both affirm that this is a very scary and dark time for Jews, for Americans, for human beings. I think that this is a scary time. And nevertheless, my understanding of history and religion is that when we are driven by fear, we don't tend to make good decisions. Mm-hmm. And the best outcomes in human history happen when we are driven not by terror, but when we're driven by a sense of hope and possibility. And so I want to reaffirm for my community, for my people, what might be possible. It's hard to think that way when you're scared for your life, obviously. And yet we have to reaffirm the common threads of humanity that exist within and far beyond the borders and boundaries of the Jewish community.
Sure. One of the other greater dangers that goes hand in hand with fear is the lure of hopelessness and being simply overwhelmed by the threats and dangers that one sees no way out. So this new year, where do you seek and where do you tell people to look for hope?
It has been said in many times and in many ways that the greatest enemy of freedom is despair. The way that I see hope as embedded in the Jewish narrative is in the story of the Exodus from Egypt, which is not the narrative that we're particularly focused on this holiday, and yet is one that we remind ourselves of. Traditional Jews repeat this narrative three times a day in our prayers. And so we're constantly reminding ourselves of this journey, of the possibility of movement from darkness to light. This is a people that were enslaved for hundreds of years. And then all of a sudden, when nobody imagined that freedom was even possible anymore, was called to take its first step toward liberation and freedom. And that message as the core and central narrative of the Jewish people, and one that also many people who are not Jewish hold as central narrative of their faith and their community as well, is one that continues to remind us that no matter how dark the day, we have to continue to seek out possibilities of light, because the journey does not end in a place of darkness. It might begin in darkness, but it does not end there. And so we're constantly moving toward greater light and greater possibility. And for us as a people, what's really crucial is that this was never a message that was intended only for the Jewish people, mm-hmm. but rather this was a message that's about humanity. It's a message that we learned as Jews by our own journey, but it doesn't come to teach us that the Jews walk on a trajectory toward freedom, but rather that since we were slaves in Egypt, we know what the experience of oppression and persecution is like. We know what the experience of darkness is like, and our journey for the rest of time is we live in a permanent affirmative obligation that we hold to walk and to help other people walk from darkness to light and from slavery to freedom.
Rabbi Brous, spiritually speaking, where is Egypt today?
You know, Michael Walzer, who's a political theorist, says wherever you are, it's somebody's Egypt. So whether that's in Los Angeles or whether that's in Syria, there are people who are suffering, people for whom their greatest nightmare is being realized all around us. One of our core jobs, and part of the reason we have to do such intentional and intense personal spiritual work, is so that we can be awake enough in the world to see and recognize the ways in which our reality is someone else's Egypt, and then find the moral courage to help reach out a hand and lift them toward greater possibility. Egypt exists all over the world now.
That's such a helpful way to talk about it. Rabbi Sharon Brous is the founder and leader of the Ikar community in Los Angeles, re-engaging participants in spiritual practice and issues of social justice. She's a popular writer and a public speaker. Rabbi Brous is much in demand, so I am really grateful that she found the time to be with us today. Sharon, thank you for joining us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, and I hope the new year brings blessings of inspiration and peace for all of us.
Thank you. Same to you. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. And if you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. The kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that we strive to present every week is virtually impossible to find anywhere else. So please consider helping us to keep this important work going. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us, please. You can do that throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. Our listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about this show and encourage them to listen also. State of Belief Radio is the production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.